From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Bob Inglis was a U.S. congressman representing the 4th District of South Carolina from 1993 to 1999, and again from 2005 to 2011. He received high marks from his colleagues and constituents until he embraced one subject, climate change. As a result, he was unseated in a wave of Tea Party activism that voted in Trey Gowdy.
Bob Inglis is coming to Salt Lake City later this week to share his story on why addressing human-caused climate change is so anathema to many Republican platforms, while at the same time fits in so well with many conservative principles, like the free market, shared accountability, and risk-based analysis and action.
Bob will be giving talks at both BYU and the Hinckley Institute of Politics on Friday, November 3rd, and we'll provide you the details later. Congressman Inglis joins us in the first part of the show.
Then in the second half of the show, we'll speak with John Schutz, a local water rights attorney based in Salt Lake City, who gave a talk this past Friday afternoon on the history of water rights in Utah.
We'll talk about that history, how the policies and procedures regarding water rights and their use were first established using ecclesiastical control, when that eventually changed, and why, even with growing demand and regional drought, concepts like use it or lose it are still employed today.
All that, and we'll have information on a couple of events coming up this weekend that relate to the environment and sustainability. Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital and New Park Town Center, with new retail spaces and a year-round community development. Information about New Park Town Center is available at 801-303-5440.
Your kids need clear communication, especially when it comes to alcohol. As parents, be specific. Absolutely no underage drinking. Not one drop of alcohol under any circumstances. Learn more at parentsempowered.org.
Valley Behavioral Health is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone is former Congressman Bob Inglis. He's coming to Salt Lake City later this week. We'll be giving some talks over at BYU and also the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We'll give you specific details a little bit later. Bob's interesting because his positions align well with most conservatives on all issues, except perhaps, and this is changing, we'll talk about it, and that's climate change. In fact, his children told him that they wouldn't vote for him unless he got his act together on this issue. And he joins us. I'll stop there and let Bob explain more. Bob, thanks so much for joining us on This Green Earth this morning.
Great to be with you, Chris. I'm particularly excited about what you just said, that yes, things are changing, and that is the case, I believe, that conservatives are beginning to realize how conservative it is to deal with climate change.
Yeah, and we do want to talk more about that, how things have changed, but let's go back to when things were a little more difficult, around 2009, 2010, you started to learn about the issues surrounding climate change. And what was your takeaway with respect to that?
Well, yes, we're going back to the unpleasantness of late, aren't we?
Yes.
So 2010 was a particularly bad time to be talking as a conservative about climate change, right? It's the depths of the Great Recession. The orthodoxy was really important. When a tribe is under pressure, orthodoxy is important. And so the orthodoxy at that moment was, I don't believe in climate change, and you shouldn't either. Is a rather really antagonistic atheism as to climate change, if you will. And so just a disbelief and an adamant disbelief. So that I was contrary to, because I as you just said, had sort of a metamorphosis on this. I was in Congress for 6 years saying climate change was nonsense. All I knew was Al Gore was for it, and since I was a conservative, I was therefore against it. Then my son came to me when I was running for Congress again after a six-year period of doing commercial real estate law. And he said to me, Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment. He's the oldest of our five kids, just turned 18, so he was voting for the first time. So really more than threatening me, what he was doing was saying, Dad, I love you, and really you can be better than you were before. So how about make this English 2.0, the new and improved version? So that was step one. Step two in this metamorphosis for me was going to the Antarctica and seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. And then step three was being inspired really in a spiritual sort of awakening with an Aussie climate scientist showing us the glories of the Great Barrier Reef and telling me about conservation changes he was making in his life to love God and love people. And so that really inspired me. I wanted to be like Scott Heron, that Aussie climate scientist, loving God and loving people. So that's when I came home and introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. Probably not the best timing in the midst of the Great Recession, you know?
Right. But you felt that was important. You were willing to cross that line.
Yeah, because, you know, I was going to be voting against cap and trade because I thought that was hopelessly complicated, embarrassing in the free allocations for the well-connected that would have decimated American manufacturing. And it was a massive tax increase. So for all those reasons, I knew I was going to vote no on cap and trade. But I have this perhaps quaint notion, but I think it should be a notion that we should accept if you're serving in Congress. If you're going to oppose something, you need to propose the alternative. And so I propose the alternative to cap and trade, and that is this very simple carbon tax that's paired with a dollar-for-dollar reduction in other taxes or a dividend of all the money back, and then an application of that tax to imports. So it's a very simple way of dealing with the problem of climate change, and it uses the fixing the economics in order to fix the climate change problem.
And when you proposed this, did your colleagues jump on board with you? Was there immediate opposition? How did the reaction to that look?
Well, you know, one of the ones that jumped on with me, and it really is quite telling, isn't it, is my good friend Jeff Flake of Arizona. Jeff Flake was one of my co-sponsors on that bill because he knows it's rock-solid conservatism. He was attacked for it in his first Senate race in the primary with a Republican telling him, oh, that's liberal. Why'd you get on that bill with that guy from South Carolina that lost in a Republican primary?
Right.
And so I knew that Jeff Flake would not back down because, believe me, Jeff Flake does not back down. He's a very principled guy. And so he said, yes, absolutely, I was on that bill. It's the right way to deal with climate change. Unfortunately, Jeff is a rare bird, though. I mean, he's an actual conservative who thinks things through very carefully and then sticks with his principles. So, yeah, in answer to your question, not a whole lot jumped on it. But thankfully, I was certainly encouraged that somebody as thoughtful and as thoroughly conservative as Jeff Flake was on it with me.
Well, unfortunately, too, though, that was used against you. I guess your embracing of climate change, and among other things, was used against you by Trey Gowdy, let's say, in the 2010 primaries. And you eventually lost it to Trey Gowdy. And was that pretty much the end of your political career at that point?
Well, yes, in elective office, perhaps.
Yeah.
But, you know, the wonderful thing is, at that point, A Foundation came to me and said, you know, Angus, you're a very unusual zoo animal. An actual conservative, you know, a 93 American Conservative Union rating, 100% Christian Coalition, 100% National Right to Life, A with the National Rifle Association, zero with the Americans for Democratic Action, a liberal group, and 23 by some mistake with the AFL-CIO. I was really hoping for a zero. And so They said, you know, an actual conservative who says that climate change is real, will you speak and write for the proposition? So I said, sure. The cage is nice and the food is good. Yeah. I'll be your zoo animal. And so the cage is very nice. I get to come to Salt Lake City later this week. So I'm very excited about that. And I think the food will probably be good too there.
Yes. Yes. And I think you'll be warmly embraced by your the constituents out here who are changing their minds here. Go ahead now.
You know, I wanted to mention that last week we spoke with a student from BYU.
Right.
And Chris and I asked, and he was working on something called the Climate Campaign, trying to increase conversation about climate at the university. And we asked him before the show, are you, you know, feeling a lot of opposition? What's the feedback like? And he said, oh, all the students, we're all millennials. We all get it. We all know about climate change.
It's not even a conversation,
not an issue,
per se.
Yeah.
It's more about action at this point.
So I think that is a sign of kind of this change that you're talking about and seeing. And it'll be interesting to see what the reception is like here in Utah.
Yeah, I think it is indicative of what's happening. Is young conservatives are with us. Young people of faith are with us. Their parents and their grandparents, a little bit harder for us. But young people plan on living on this glorious earth a little bit longer maybe than their grandparents or great-grandparents. And so they are concerned about that future. And they want my party, the Republican Party, to be the grand opportunity party, not the grumpy old party. And so we've sort of stuck in this grumpy old party affect for a while. And young conservatives say, don't we have an answer to this? And of course we do have an answer to this. And so I'm very encouraged by what the BYU students are doing, because it should signal to elected officials that where the future is. And so I think we'll find that the change comes. Of course, the challenge is those grandparents and great grandparents vote more often than those college students do. Right. So that's what the crusty old politician would say if they were on the phone right now with us.
Right. We're speaking with Bob Inglis. Bob was a U.S. congressman representing the 4th District of South Carolina from 1993 to 1999, and again from 2005 to 2011. He is coming to Salt Lake City to give a couple of talks. One will be at the BYU campus, I believe it's on Thursday, and he's also going to be giving a talk at the Hinckley Institute of Politics this Friday, November 3rd, at 12 noon. You can go to, you can go to republican.org, that's republican.org, to learn more about these two talks. And that's a website that you've started, or an organization you've started, correct?
That's right. And so republicen.org is a place where we're building a community of like-minded conservatives who want to show our elected officials that we really care about climate change and that we conservatives have an answer to it. You know, it's sort of like the cheer in middle school at Spirit Week, you know, where one side of the gymnasium says, "We got spirit. Yes, we do. We got spirit. How about you?" You know, and so what we want to have this community saying is, "We got a solution. Yes, we do. We got a solution. How about you?" And so we want to enter the competition of ideas as conservatives. And the exciting thing I think we're going to find is America is going to win that competition. The whole world's going to win that competition, because once we start that cheer up, once conservatives engage, what we're going to find out is there are many progressives that agree with exactly the same solution. And so what we'll find is what I've found along the way, which is that Art Laffer, one of Ronald Reagan's economics advisors at the famous Laffer curve, that means when you cut taxes, you get an increased take in government revenues in certain conditions. Art Laffer is a neighbor of Al Gore's in Nashville, Tennessee. Art's been over to Al's house. They talked it through, and they came to the conclusion that this carbon tax that I mentioned earlier, that is paired with a cut in existing taxes or a dividend of the money back, and then an application of the tax to imports, that concept works for both Art Laffer, Reagan's advisor because he wants to reduce taxes on income. And it works for Al Gore because he knows that free enterprise will get to work here on innovation if the economics are fixed. And so I figure if we can bring Art Laffer and Al Gore together, we can bring America together.
Right.
So while I'm saying this, we're building up Republicans and turning them into Republicans and to show that there's an energy and enterprise solution to climate. But at the end of the day, what we're going to find out is progressives are for the same thing, too. And then America is going to come together and lead the world to a solution.
Right. So tell us in a little bit more detail about this energy and enterprise solution to climate change and the carbon tax. And, you've mentioned it a couple of times. Give us, a minute or so describing that in a little more depth.
Yeah. So the idea here is to attach to products the costs that are currently not seen at the power meter or at the pump. And so, for example, if I'm coal-fired electricity, English coal-fired electricity, currently, I get away with dumping my soot into the sky without any accountability. Sure, maybe I've got to scrub it a little bit, but if I had to scrub it completely, my cost would go up. And I would say to the local member of Congress, oh, that'd be a terrible idea. I'm going to have to increase my rates, and your constituents aren't going to be happy with me or with you. But what we live to see today is when a conservative says back to me, Inglis, we're already seeing the full cost of coal-fired electricity. We're seeing it at the hospital where people are being admitted because you're socializing your soot. And gigs up, Inglis coal-fired electricity. Mm-hmm. Be accountable. Be even biblically accountable. Hold your ash on your property. Don't do on your property something that harms someone else's life or property.
Right.
So those are the health costs. And then, of course, there are climate damages I'm causing as well. So the idea is to use a carbon tax to attribute those costs to my power so that I put it on the meter and show the actual cost of my electricity with the health damages, with the climate damages. And then what happens is you can eliminate all the subsidies for wind and solar and electric cars and all those things because now they can compete on a level playing field. If you're going to make me, Inglis coal-fired electricity, fully accountable, the renewables don't need any subsidies. They don't need any propping up. Now, it stinks for me at Inglis coal-fired electricity, but it's great for my neighbors because they breathe better. And it's great for the world because then innovation happens and we move away from being limited to, well, if you've got coal or you got oil, you got wealth. But we all have sunshine. We all have wind. And if we get better batteries, then we can light up dark places of the world that are currently filled with a lot of animosity toward those who have those things. We can have a more peaceful, prosperous world. It's really pretty exciting.
Yeah, and you must be encouraged by the formation of the Climate Solutions Caucus in Congress, Republicans and Democrats coming together to hammer out solutions like that.
Very exciting, yeah. It's gone from 0 to 60.
Yeah.
That's great growth, you know. And it's 2x2. It's an Noah's Ark concept. You got to come on to the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus in the House with a Democrat in tow if you're a Republican. And so the idea is to build actual bipartisanship there. So it's a great thing that's happening.
So we just received a question from a listener who wants to hear what are the most compelling points to get somebody that is a staunch Republican to acknowledge climate change. So what would you recommend? How would you start in on that conversation?
Well, if it's a person of faith, I'd talk to them about creation care. Mm-hmm. If it's a person of economics, I'd talk to them about, let's go watch Dr. Milton Friedman on the Phil Donahue show in the 1980s, answering Phil, a liberal's question. Milton Friedman, one of the fathers of modern conservatism, is asked by Phil Donahue, well, what do you do about pollution then? And Dr. Friedman says, well, you tax it, of course. Then he goes on to explain better than I've just explained, internalizing negative externalities, making it so those negative effects of my endless coal-fired electricity are revealed at the meter and at the pump. And so, and if it's somebody that isn't inclined to buy the science or isn't moved by faith to do something about it, then I'd ask him, well, let's then go with Art Laffer, who says, okay, so you're agnostic or even atheistic as to climate change. You just don't believe. Still, wouldn't you want to untax income and tax something you maybe want less of? That's what Art Laffer says. He says he's agnostic about climate change. He doesn't know whether it's real or not, but he says he doesn't need to know. He says, all I need to know is you're taxing income, and you're not taxing something you maybe want less of. At republician.org, we think we definitely want less of it, but Art says you maybe want less CO2. Tax that, untax income. And so there are various ways to approach it, but mostly what this involves is people being able to turn around, because we've had this culturally marked as something that only liberals care about. And that's why I'm so excited about what the BYU students are doing, because they're helping to unmark that and say, no, no, really, we're all in this together. So how about conservatives are going to join this conversation, too? We're part of the solution.
Well, I'd like to think that we're all in this together, except for those who are in the White House or running the EPA. What is your thoughts about being us, the U.S., pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords, and what's going on with the EPA?
It's very disappointing that President Trump decided to withdraw us from Paris. It's not the place where I think my country should be, sniveling on the sidelines with Syrians and whimpering something about how it's not fair to us. This voluntary agreement is somehow unfair and terribly wrong for us. Mm-hmm. It sounds like just a sniveling little child on the sidelines. That's not where I see my country. I see my country out on the field saying, we're going to lead this thing. And so very disappointing that President Trump withdrew us from Paris. But I will tell you, there is sort of a silver lining, and we quite routinely look for silver linings at republician.org, you know. And so the silver lining is sort of this. People joining us, standing with us at republician.org, it's a simple thing to do. You just go there and you just click on it and stand with us. Our signups have gone up because I think people realize, you mean we can do nothing? Nothing at all about climate change? Mm-hmm. That's a very naked feeling. And I think people are joining us because they say, wait a minute, no, I want to do something about climate change. I think somebody in the government should be focused on this.
Well, with that in mind, we have just about 1 minute left. What can people do to get involved with Republican, your organization?
Well, of course, we'd love to have them join us at either of these events coming up this week. But also, it is simple just to go to republician.org and to click on Stand With Us, because what will happen then is members of Congress will see how many we've got with us, because part of politics is who you got with you. And so if we have lots of people with us, then elected officials will say, yeah, this is something I need to respond to. I need to get involved with this. Right now, they don't sense a constituency of support for action on climate change. That's what we live to change at republician.org.
Well, again, Bob Inglis is coming to Salt Lake City to give a couple of talks, one this Thursday. I don't have all the details on that. You'll be speaking at BYU, and that's open to the public. And you're also giving a talk at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on Friday at noon. And you can learn more about both those talks by going to Bob's website, RepublicEN. That's all one word, mashed with RepublicEN.org, and learn about your tour, because you're going around the country giving talks these days, aren't you?
Yeah, so we're on a 10-city, 10-week Encourage tour, of which I may collapse by the end of November. So long about Thanksgiving, if you don't hear from me anymore, it's because I've collapsed.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and for all you're doing.
Bob, and you know what? You you were just a man ahead of your time back in 2010 when it comes to Republican views towards climate change and the moral obligations associated with that. And now if you are in Congress, you would be leading up that Climate Solutions Caucus. I know that.
Yeah, that's right. So the pioneers take the arrows and the settlers get the land. We're happy for them to get the land.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you, arrows and all, this Thursday and Friday. Former Congressman,
great. Well, good to-
thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning on This Green Earth, Bob.
Great to be with you.
All right. Hey, let's take a break for a couple underwriters and sponsors. And we come back, we'll be speaking with John Schutz. He's a water rights attorney. He's going to be talking about the history of water rights here in Utah.
And how this crazy system came to be.
And it's still kind of crazy. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
This is Brenda with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage collection. Information about what is acceptable to put in your curbside recycling bin can be found at summitcountyrecycles.org. Please help Summit County be clean. Remember to recycle.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I am Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us in the second half of this show is John Schutz. He is a water rights attorney with Maybe Right and James here in Salt Lake City, Utah. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Chris and I both attended your talk at the library at the end of last week.
It was full.
It was jam-packed.
Friday afternoon, 4:30 at the library. And John, you packed the meeting room. Good job.
Yeah.
So, I don't want to take all the credit for that, but I was pleased to have such a large attendance.
Well, it was a great event and really enlightening, especially to those of us who I think work, you know, on the periphery of water rights and with water.
And trying to understand them.
And yes, attempting to understand them. So you recently came out with a small book on this topic about water rights. Is that right?
That's right.
So, well, let's start here that the Mormons come to Utah. They decide this is the place, literally. And the first thing they do, I guess, is they kind of wrestle control of what's now called City Creek and set up water storage using City Creek. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, as I read it, they did that within hours of arriving. And part
really?
Of the problem was they arrived in July, right? And so when they're in the middle of the growing season and they didn't have time to lose.
Okay. So that's critical, although they have, you know, I guess they quickly realized they had a whole Great Salt Lake, but that was unusable. So they dam up City Creek, and then how do they begin to parcel out the water from there? Who gets what?
So that was a purely ecclesiastical function, and so they would divide the land itself into lots, both residential lots and farming lots, and each the bishop in each ward and each sector of people would then divvy up those lots. And so the bishop was the water master, as well as the ecclesiastical leader and the judge. He did lots of things.
So so you got water based on your lot. The amount of water you got was based on the size of your lot or what you might be growing or using that water for?
Yeah, I think very early on there was enough water to go around. Mm. So basically the bishops would allocate enough water to irrigate your lots. It gets trickier later as, you know, people come into the valley and there's less water to go around. But initially, yeah, it was proportional to what you needed to grow your crop.
So when does water start to become, when do we start to see shortages of water, not enough water to go around? When did those conflicts start to come up, and how long does it take to get there?
So within a couple decades, the first case I read was, you know, late 1860s. It culminated in the 70s. And what's interesting is it was both a water quantity and a water quality case. You had an industrial process that was going on up above the residential side of things, and it was sending down toxic minerals. And so the settlers down below brought a court case to stop both the diversion of water in terms of quantity as well as the polluting of water with these chemicals, and they prevailed.
They prevailed. Okay. So the town downstream was able to have the town upstream stop using and polluting their source of water.
Yeah, and so in the first case, it was what they called an ore crusher. Later on, we have cases where it's town versus town, both parties desiring the same use, but because one was there first, they have a higher claim to the water.
Okay, but if I remember, as you described me in this, you said that the church was not very happy with that decision.
So this is the Goshen versus Mona case, and that's one where you have two towns vying for the same water. And the downstream town was there first by a few years,
right,
as opposed to the upstream town. And so they went to court, and John Taylor at the time, who was the prophet, the acting prophet, was rather upset, and not because of the result, because in quotes that I found from him, he agreed with the result that the downstream but earlier party should have prevailed. He was upset about them having gone to secular courts as opposed to trying to handle it within the church process.
And so is this when that transition from a church-run or an ecclesiastical system to, you know, a secular state-run system
agency
happened?
Right.
Yeah. How did that transition take place?
So I think that was a very apparent example of that. But there were also laws that were passed that allowed parties to hold water rights as personal property. And up until then, they had been more or less attached to the ground. And once you have the water rights themselves being personal property, you can move them other places. The same law established the state engineer a little bit later. It becomes a secularized system of private property rights. They're a little bit different than land private property rights, but essentially you have a property right in water separate from any sort of allocation from the church or management from the church. So that happened in the late 1880s, 1890s.
So what made trying to establish water rights out in the West different from establishing, let's say, water rights back East?
So back East, they have what's called riparian water law. And under that system, anybody who's next to a stream can divert sufficient water for their needs. And in a system where you have rain-fed agriculture and more water in terms of more streams and just more quantity of water, that system works. Out west, it doesn't work where you have, I mean, think of the Wasatch Front. You have very defined streams in certain areas, but if you're, say, between Big and Little Cottonwood and there's no creek there, you've got to move water from the creek over to where your lot is, and it's not going to be adjacent to either one of those. And so just the physical geography and the layout of land and water courses necessitates a different system out in the West than in the East.
So give us kind of a summary of what the system is here in the West now. And I know that this can get complex quickly, but kind of give us the overriding principles here. Or give us a quick summary of kind of like what is water law in the West? I think especially here in Park City, a lot of people are not necessarily from this area. And so this different set of water rights comes as a surprise.
Yeah.
So one of the major tenets of, it's called prior appropriation doctrine is what we have in the West. in Utah and the rest of the West mostly, is that the first party there gets the water. And this is a function of, say, if you're a miner and you need to move it 10 miles to your mining site, you don't want somebody interrupting that. And so if you're there first, you get it first. In the cases we talked about earlier, examples of this, it would be difficult if you're downstream to have people just go upstream from you and begin diverting water. And so the rule established comes into play pretty quickly that the first party there has a superior claim than a later party, even if they're upstream. Another one is that you have to put it to a beneficial use. And so the fear here was you would have people speculating in water and amassing these big amounts of water that they weren't using for speculation or monopoly. And so one of the major tenets also is that you have to put it to a use. If it's just idle, that becomes subject to forfeiture, and it can be forfeited by the state or by court and moved to another use, another beneficial use. The last major tenet is it's transferable. So it's a private property right that you can move between owners, between lots, between land, as opposed to only having a claim if you're adjacent to a stream, which is the riparian system. But that, those are the basic ones. It gets complicated from there.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. We'll hold there. Because actually that one, the transferable rights, that's within the same watershed though, right? Can I transfer my right from one watershed to another?
No, because one of the other major tenets is you can change it, but you can't harm other parties. Huh. And so if you went from one watershed to another, that would essentially be extracting water from this second watershed that wasn't there before. It'd be an increased use. And so, no, you can't do that.
So you mentioned that this prior appropriation doctrine is, you know, it's the law here in Utah, but also throughout the West. So did that law all originate here in Utah? Did this kind of spring up simultaneously in different places? How did that become the law of the West?
It's more the latter. It was going on at the same time. I mean, it starts with the miners in Colorado and the miners in California who, again, need to move water from where it is to where they want to use it. That's right. And so in Utah, it was being created at the same time, but in both those places, it was purely secular. And so that became the formal law more quickly than in Utah. But the principles are the same in Utah, and they were evolving through an ecclesiastical setting, but don't become formalized until a little bit later. But it's all happening at the same time in the same places, again, for the same reasons, mostly geography. Hmm.
So this water law is rooted in such deep history in our state. And so I want to ask, like, what does that look like now? You know, you practice water law on a day-to-day basis. Are these the same kinds of conflicts that we saw 100 years ago? What are the issues that you face look like now?
So a lot of what I do is moving water from one use to another. Most of the state is fully appropriated, meaning you can't even apply for new water through the permitting system. And so often the name of the game is change applications, moving water from one use to another, whether that be irrigation to municipal or just from one place of use to another. And so I do a lot of that. It's also surprising that the conflicts are surprisingly similar. I have a case where, you know, two distant family members, and there's one little creek that goes through their property, and there's only so much to go around. And so who is entitled to that and on what basis and who has priority are still very relevant issues for them.
Hmm. So I want to know about, if you just joined us, we're speaking with John Schutz, and I hope we pronounce your last name correctly. Was it Schutz?
It's Schutz, but I
told Nell it was Schutz.
he's lying.
Yeah, you're right, I am. It's John Schutz. He is a water rights attorney with the firm of Maybe Wright and James down in Salt Lake City. We're talking about the history of water rights in Utah. And when a water right is given, is that in the form of what units? Is it like gallons per year, cubic feet per year, acre feet per year? How is that expressed?
So it can be different ways. Oftentimes, it could be a CFS amount, which is just a velocity, an instantaneous measurement. A lot of times, in terms of irrigation, what you have is a designated number of acres. So let's just say 10 acres. And then there's what's called a duty, which is it could be anywhere from 2 to 6 acre feet in the state. And that would be the maximum amount you could put on the land for that use. Hmm. So if you have 10 acres and the duty is 4, the most you can use would be 40 acre feet. Now, if you conserve water, if you put in a center pivot as opposed to flood irrigation and only use 20 of that, you don't get the extra 20. Hmm. That duty is a cap. It's not a fixed amount.
So that's where the use it or lose it concept comes in?
So it is. And that gets tricky fast because you are using it on those 10 acres. And so you're maximizing your use. In other states, you can market the amount of water you've saved. So if you're entitled to 40 and you use 20, you could sell the extra 20 to another use to oftentimes compensate for your efficiency measures. Here, that's not the case. And so they wouldn't lose that 20 because they still have the right to irrigate all the land they have. But there's no efficiency incentive. There's no incentive for them to conserve that water from an economic standpoint.
Hmm.
Well, along those lines, where do you see water law, I don't know, kind of the future of water rights and water law here in Utah? Are there potential changes on the horizon in relation to this conservation piece?
Yeah, so that is one that there's been grumblings on for a long time. And it hasn't got a lot of traction, though. It has in other states. But even in other states where it's explicit, in California, the law is explicit that water is not going to be forfeited if it's, you know, preserved through conservation. Water right holders are still ingrained after a century of use it or lose it, that they're fearful to even go through with it, even where there's explicit statutory protection. So that's, we're working through that in Utah. Another thing we're trying to do is water banking. And so if you have a reservoir and I don't use my water, I could put it into this bank, a physical reservoir. Other parties could use it, and that way you could move it to other uses if I don't want to irrigate that year. That's another thing that's in the future that allows us some flexibility in terms of where it's used, but also navigating that use it or lose it principle.
Yeah, I was curious about the construction of reservoirs over time. Does that construction open up more opportunities for water right ownership?
Yes, it can. If it increases the amount of water in the system,
uh-huh.
and that's a tricky thing to prove because there's only a finite amount of water that varies every year, but if you capture water that wouldn't otherwise be usable, then that can be a new use. But even those, I mean, the last reservoir we built was 30 years ago, mm-hmm. and so that's a Central Utah project. It still doesn't, they're using that water. It's still hard to create new water.
Okay.
So kind of along those lines of creating new water, and I don't know if this falls into that category, but what about groundwater and wells? You know, a lot of people get their culinary water, the water for their house, from a well. Where does that piece fall into all of this?
So as of 1903, the only way you could get a right to divert water was via the permitting process. That became the law for groundwater in sometime in 1930. And so from then on, the only way groundwater and surface water is treated is connected. And so oftentimes municipalities, what they'll do is move water from, say, an irrigation surface source out of a stream to a municipal well. And the interference principles, you know, the inability to harm somebody in that change applies equally to groundwater as it does surface water. And so it's regulated just the same. It's analyzed from an impact standpoint to other users, whether it's groundwater or surface water.
Right.
Now, what about when the water level, you know, the level in the aquifer, the groundwater, starts to drop because a well is using, you know, a certain amount of water that impacts it in that way?
So that's interesting. There's a case, I think it's South Jordan, and there was a party who had a well. South Jordan came in later with some deeper wells and lowered the aquifer below the intakes of this irrigator's well. And the court basically said, well, there's still water in the aquifer, so you've just got to deepen your well. which I think is sort of a negative incentive to mine the aquifer. But if there's water there, that's the principle. You have to chase it.
Yeah.
If it becomes to a point where there's interference, then it goes to a priority system. Whoever has the senior claim is entitled to all of their water before the junior appropriator. But there is a notion that a certain party can suck it down a certain amount, and the other party either has to deepen their wells or go without.
Wow, the burden is placed on the aggrieved in that sense. And you have literally a race to the bottom of the aquifer. That's what gets set up.
And I don't know how far that would go. Like I said, if it comes to a point where the water isn't there for the senior appropriator, then they'd have an interference claim where the other party may be required to stop. But if it's fairly accessible, this case at least said you've got to chase it.
And at your talk, you mentioned briefly what can happen when aquifers and groundwater is drained to an extent that the land itself can actually
subside.
Yeah, the Central Valley of California, where I grew up, is a prime example of that. California didn't regulate groundwater at all until a few years ago. And so if there wasn't surface water, you just deepened your wells, and that was literally a race to the bottom. And there's the subsidence of, you know, up to 40 feet. And the problem is, once that aquifer subsides, you lose the capacity for it to store water, and you can't bring that back. So it's a double-edged sword in terms of loss of water and loss of storage capacity underneath.
40 feet is 40 just feet. Mind-blowing.
And if you want to look at a four-story building here, we're looking across the way, and that's 40 feet for a four-story building of land subsidence as a result of zealous groundwater extraction.
Yeah, and there's this picture you can find on the internet that is unbelievable. It's a telephone pole and a guy standing next to it. It shows the current level, the prior level, and then where he's standing, and it's almost unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, I'm an environmental engineer, so I want to ask about a water quality question. Are water rights include any obligations for water quality, say an obligation to prevent pollution coming off your land and impacting downstream water right holders?
The answer to that is no. It becomes a Clean Water Act issue in terms of regulating constituents, but there's no, you know, that prior case that I told you about was a private nuisance case, and so if there was a significant level of damage, it would be something like that, a nuisance case, a pollution case, but it wouldn't be a water rights case.
Okay.
The conflict I see between water rights and water quality oftentimes is when a water right holder has certain permits or requirements put on them via the Clean Water Act in terms of flow, minimum stream flows, that sort of thing. That's when the two cross over most. But there's no water right mechanism by which you could stop that pollution you're talking about.
Okay. And this is rare, I'm sure, but in times of flood, excess water, is there any, is it like a free-for-all? Can I store as much water as possible if my land floods?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me about the liability for flood water, and I hadn't looked at that in a while. So, no, you can't. You've got to have a storage right to store that. And so you've got a storage right for 20 acre feet, whether it's normal stream flows or, you know, flood flows. You can't store extra.
What? Okay. I would assume back east I could probably do that, riparian rights.
I don't know how that relates specifically to storage.
Right.
If you have a right to store. And even here, you can have really small storage facilities, but once it gets above, I think, 5 acre feet, you've got to permit it.
Yeah.
But again, you've got to have a permit for a rain barrel. You have to have a permit for a reservoir.
Right.
Anything that impacts anybody else, you've got to permit it at this point.
Okay.
Well, one final question before we let you go here. I have to ask how you came to specialize in this area of law and focus here in Utah.
So I went to law school at UC Davis, which is a big, you know, water law place. Sacramento is a big water law place. And I watched a documentary called Cadillac Desert, which chronicles the history of water in the West. mostly through the lens of tracking the Bureau of Reclamation. And I just immediately fell in love with how complicated it is, the historical element, how there's not always a morally compelling outcome between two farmers. There's no right answer necessarily. And it's always emotional. This is people's livelihood. They can't live without it, which I think makes for interesting work. And I fell in love with it immediately and still love going to work every day.
Well, John Schutz is a water rights attorney with the firm of Mabee, Wright, and James. And, John, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way?
Probably going to my website, which is mwjlaw.com, and my profile's on there, and it gives an explanation of what we do.
Great. mwj.com. John Schutz.
mwjlaw.com.
mwjlaw.com. Thank you. John Schutz, thanks so much again for taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
All right. Hey, let's take one last break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we got to wrap up. How about that? It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Dr. Bob Miller here from Miller Orthodontics, proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton, who makes us all smile. Embrace is a technology to straighten teeth without anything showing. More information about Embrace is at myembrace.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We got a couple minutes, but do we have a calendar event item?
Yeah, just really quick, we wanted to mention that the Park City Film Series and Eats Park City are putting on the Food and Film Weekend this weekend and showing some films that relate to sustainable food and food waste. So we've got The Big Sick on Saturday, November 4th at 8 p.m. and Wasted, The Story of Food Waste on Sunday, November 5th at 6 p.m. And they both have a post-film discussion. Some interesting environmental topics this weekend at the film series.
Perfect. And, of course, again, if you can, get down to the Hinckley Institute of Politics this Friday at noon to hear Bob Inglis speak. Or listen to our interview we just had with him if you didn't get a chance. It was a great chat with him. We thank him again for taking the time to come on. Our show will be posted on the station website, kpcw.org. And again, thanks to John Schutz, water rights attorney with Mabee, Wright, and James, talking about trying to explain once and for all the labyrinth that is our water rights here out in Utah.
I just found the photo that he mentioned
of that
man standing next to this telephone pole. It is
incredible. It lives.
It's
impressive.
It is all over the internet.
Okay. All right. Let's thank our sponsors and underwriters, of course, who help make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and importantly, listeners like you.
You can always join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth. You can post comments to the show, ideas for the show.
That's right. And we love to hear from you via email as well.
Yeah.
What you'd like to hear, recommendations on topics that you would like addressed. And you can reach us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM in Park City.
Remember, we've got your Wasatch back.
Thanks again. And NPR News is coming up.